This is an ABC podcast.
This is ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
And 25 years later, 30 years later, 50 years later, he's still my brother, and it's still going to hurt just as much as the day it did, but we get stronger and we get on with it, don't we?
Nearly 30 years on from the Newcastle earthquake, a very personal reflection on one of Australia's worst ever natural disasters. And we head to Tassie, where a farm school has turned feasting wedge-tailed eagles into a learning tool.
We absolutely love the wedge-tailed eagles. They're a stunning sight to see when they're in our environment. But obviously for our enterprise, it was a bit of a risk losing so many girls, and we wanted to protect them as much as we could.
I'm Alex Hyman. Those stories and more here on Australia Wide. Today, Prime Minister Scott Morrison and Opposition Leader Anthony Albanese, along with other ministers, have visited Western New South Wales to meet with drought-affected farmers as part of a bush summit. Federal drought support funding was high on the agenda, as was the Prime Minister's plan to bridge the urban-rural divide. Tim Fuchs has been at the summit today in Dubbo. Tim, what was the objective of today's summit?
Well, it was the opportunity, Alex, for a range of industry representatives, farming groups, politicians to get together in Dubbo, which is one of the worst affected areas affected by drought in Western New South Wales. And it was one of the first occasions where you had such a lineup of perhaps 250 people who gathered in a room to hear all sorts of ideas, policy objectives, the impact the drought is having on particularly eastern states in Australia that, like New South Wales, that have been affected for, more than 2 years now. And it was an idea, I guess, for people to be able to sit down, hear from the likes of the Prime Minister, and they got some big names along. They got Scott Morrison, they got the opposition leader, members of the New South Wales state government as well were here. So a very large turnout for this event.
Drought funding was obviously an important issue for many who had gathered today. What support was the Prime Minister offering?
Well, it was a very positive outlook by the Prime Minister. He spoke at length about his concerns over the city-rural divide, as he calls it, and wants to ensure that people in metropolitan areas are aware of the role that farmers play. He talked about issues such as setting up a new parliamentary committee that would look at the needs of regional and rural Australia. He talked about the existing coalition policy whereby he would like to see the farming and rural sector contribute about $100 billion to the rural industry within the next 10 or 11 years. Here's a bit of what the Prime Minister had to say today.
We know our climate is changing, and we know that drought has always been part of the Australian landscape. We know this drought won't be the last, and that's why we are seeking to establish the Future Drought Fund, with an initial investment of $3.9 billion, rising to $5 billion. The Future Drought Fund, which will draw down over $100 million each year to work and build on these resilience projects, will provide a sustainable source of funding for drought works, preparedness and recovery.
A number of people will be listening to the Prime Minister there, so touching on future drought funding, what has he offered there?
Well, this is, of course, the $5 billion Future Drought Fund, which hasn't received the support of Labor, and Labor has expressed their concerns about not so much the fund itself, but where the money is going to be coming from. And we heard the opposition leader today mentioning that he would be concerned about the funding coming from other areas of funding, such as the Building Australia Fund. Anthony Albanese, though, it was very important, it seems, for him to point out to the crowd that had gathered there that Labor is not opposed to supporting coalition plans for drought funding. He was saying he doesn't want politics to get in the way of stopping funding going through. Here's a bit of the opposition leader.
Labor will support any funding for drought funding in terms of any level of cash that the government believes should be injected into communities, we will support. So I say this, I want more money for Bridget McKenzie's portfolio, but I don't want it at the expense of Michael McCormick's. It's that simple. And I say to the government, don't play politics with this. It's too important.
Opposition leader there, Anthony Albanese. The Prime Minister also addressed, as you mentioned earlier, the urban-rural divide and even linked it to cases of animal activists trespassing onto farm properties to protest. And we've seen that in the last few years right around Australia. What did he have to say on this?
Well, he was very, very strong in his opinion on his concerns about that divide between those who live in the city and those who live in the bush. He said that those in the city and bush need to grow together, and regional Australians must realise and must need to know that their efforts and the concerns that they have going through drought are realised. And he mentioned, of course, that this bit of legislation is going through Parliament in regards to targeting animal activists and who he calls keyboard warriors from going on to farms and disrupting the life of farmers in order to try and make a point. Here's a bit more of the Prime Minister.
More recently, I've though become quite concerned, very concerned, about the disconnection between the city and the bush, and I think this is what has led Ben to bring us together today. The recent spate of highly organised farm invasions is just utterly disgraceful. As a government, we are taking strong legislative action as promised. Those laws have been introduced to criminalise these actions of these cowardly keyboard warriors who incite crimes. That'll happen next week.
And just finally, Tim, who else was heard throughout today's summit?
There were farmers there as well. There were farming lobby groups such as the New South Wales Farmers Association. There were groups from the cotton industry, irrigation farmers, grain growers. There were various panels on the concerns over towns in New South Wales running short of water. There were concerns raised about regional infrastructure, what happens with people who are leaving some of these towns which are running short of water, and also regional tourism. They'd love to see people making a trip inland into some of these areas that are affected to keep people in jobs and to keep money flowing into these towns as well. So quite a wide variety of people speaking, Alex. I guess the key now will be, yes, there was a lot of talk, but how much action are we going to see as a result of today?
Will be very interesting to see. Tim Fookes, thank you so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Alex Hyman. This year marks 30 years since one of Australia's worst natural disasters. In December 1989, Newcastle was struck by a magnitude 5.6 earthquake. It killed 13 people, injured more than 160, and damaged 50,000 buildings. But even after 30 years, the after effects of what happened that day are raw for many who lived through it. Jane Tickle was just 13 years old, and the earthquake changed her life. She lost her brother and her home. Sadly, her brother died during the clean-up of the earthquake. Jane's story is part of a commemorative exhibition, and this is now open at Newcastle Museum. She spoke to Madeline Lewis.
I was actually sitting in Broadmeadow across the road from the train lines with my girlfriend Melissa, and we were having breakfast, and we actually thought that the train had derailed. And we all ran out, and there was no derailing train, and we watched the lady down the road. She was on a ladder, and she'd fallen down, and so Melissa and I ran down, and we picked her up, and we brought her inside, and yeah. But our house was demolished because we lived on the other side of the train line, and we had a double red brick home, and it was completely demolished, so we were displaced for nearly 8 months. We were separated as the family, and I lived at certain family members' houses, and Mum went back to Sydney, and yes, so it was quite impactful on our life.
Once you had realised what had happened, describe those next few hours for me.
It was just panic. All the adults were panicking. And as a 13-year-old, when the adults are panicking, you know that things aren't good, you know. So we were put into the bathroom by my friend's parents, and we were put a mattress over our heads because they weren't sure about aftershocks or all these different things that were happening. And, yeah, so it took quite a few hours for the adults to realise and actually listen to the radio and all those things to realise that it was over and that we were safe. And that's when everyone, you sort of just watched everyone come out onto the street, and everyone sort of looking around, and it was all eerie. And the smell, I remember the smell. It was
must have been from all the bricks crunching and the different, do you know what I mean? And the smell was so significant. It was just, yeah, it changed Newcastle. It changed so many lives. It changed everything that day. It really did.
What about the following days and weeks once everyone had realised just how enormous this was?
Life didn't go back to normal. We lived at the Nine Ways Broadmeadow and it was completely demolished. So we're talking the service station that was there now, all the shops, everything that was there now, it just completely demolished. So what I was used to walking over the high level bridge and catching my bus to school and everything, as a 13-year-old, my life was completely gone. It was just, nothing was normal. There was no regularity, there was no, you know what I mean? There was just, yeah, you couldn't go into the Pink Alley Market, you couldn't do anything because town was shut. Town just closed. How does town close? Do you know what I'm saying, Maddie? Like, yeah, how does it just all stop? Well, it did. That day it did, and for the weeks it did. It just, everything stopped.
What did this mean for your family?
The displacement and the destruction of our home was bad enough, but when Philip was killed in the demolition of the Junction Public School 12 months later, that was devastating. That's when we realised that the ongoing effect of this earthquake wasn't going to stop. It wasn't going to stop. It was going to flow on. And the fact that we're here today remembering it still means that it's still flowing on. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. So a two-storey brick wall fell on top of him. He was sent at the Junction Public School. He was sent down the side of the wall by his supervisor to clear the onlookers because there was it was the last demolition that was going on for the earthquake. It was the big do, news coverage, the whole lot. And his boss sent him up the side to make sure that all the onlookers and the spectators and public were safe. And the excavator driver operator accidentally clipped the brick wall and knocked the wall that way instead of bringing it that way. And my brother was killed underneath it. So that changed our life completely, as I'm here today, still in memory of his legacy. I was raised by a single mum, and he was basically like my dad. And, yeah, here we are today, and I've got a beautiful family, and he would never had the opportunity to have babies. He was killed before him and his fiancée could start a family, but my family all have his namesake, and that's where his legacy lives on now. So
describe to me this portrait of you and the photo that you're holding and the words that are written there.
That photo is really raw for me, Maddie. It's really raw. And 25 years later, 30 years later, 50 years later, he's still my brother and it's still going to hurt just as much as the day it did. But we get stronger and we get on with it, don't we? And we move on and we have life and we live life and we live life to celebrate them.
That's Jane Tickle speaking with Madeline Lewis and reflecting on the life of her brother and the Newcastle earthquake that in December is 30 years ago. And that commemorative exhibition, Earthquake, is now open at the Newcastle Museum and runs through to October.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
Regional Australia played a major role in 1969 during the momentous Apollo 11 mission to the moon, which this week is celebrating 50 years. With the dishes at Honeysuckle Creek in the ACT, parks in New South Wales, and Carnarvon in WA often mentioned, did you know Australia also played another role in vital communications between Houston and the Apollo astronauts? Bob Nesdeloff is a retired member of the RAAF who now calls Wagga in the New South Wales Riverina home. He was working at RAAF base Darwin when the US Air Force landed some pretty special aircraft at the airstrip there. Here he is speaking to Oscar Wills.
We were told that there was a communications black spot out over the Timor Sea at that time, and so they deployed some Boeing EC-135s and C-130s to fly and rotation and cover that black spot as the spacecraft went around the world and then went out to the moon as the Earth circulated so that they could maintain 24 hours communication link to the spacecraft. And overall, they sent two C-130s and four EC-135s.
Why did they choose Darwin? You said that the Timor Sea was where these black spots for communication were. So What sort of role did Darwin play operationally?
The unit was 6549 OMS Space Support Unit, who worked for NASA. RAF Base Darwin was the host for that unit. They landed on the at the Strip in Darwin and were parked at the bomber replenishment area.
So how did you react when you found out that you would suddenly be having an involvement in what was something that was making waves around the world at the time?
Totally unexpected. I was duty crew and rostered to sleep by the duty crew phone. I'd gone to bed at about 11 o'clock. 1 o'clock in the morning, I get a phone call from air traffic control to say, can you go down to the BRA and marshal in these aircraft because the Americans aren't confident in marshalling their aircraft on the BRA at in the dark, as they'd only been there for a few hours themselves.
So was this the first time you'd heard of this?
We knew they were coming, but we were told we weren't required, but turns out we were required.
Then you were. So you then marshalled in these aircraft?
Yeah, four of them, C-130 and three EC-135s.
So these are black spot resolving aircraft. What did they look like?
The EC-135s were by Boeing, and they're 707s. They had a big radome on the nose that, when they landed and were parked, came within about 2 feet of the ground. And they took me up into one and had walked me through it. And there was an aisle down the full length of the aircraft, but all the way on the other side was just heaps and heaps of electronic equipment and work bays for the full length of the aircraft.
Were they secretive about it, or were they proud, you know, saying that, look at this gear, we're playing an important role in ensuring that the Apollo mission can stay in contact with the Earth?
No, they were just matter-of-fact, and, you know, they're quite happy to show me through, which I thought was a privilege that I'd marshalled them in. I'd never expected to go for a walk through it.
And was there any kind of a sense of emergency in case something did go wrong? Were they concerned?
No. They just seemed to go about their normal job as if everything was going to go okay. In Darwin, we never actually got to see it on TV because TV didn't come to Darwin until 1972. So the only time I got to see it was on Movie Tone News at the cinema a couple of weeks later.
Okay, so that was about as much contact with the whole thing that you got. What about the rest of the town of Darwin at the time?
Because where the BRA is located, I don't even think the local media knew.
And is there any commemoration of this event that exists now?
Not to my knowledge.
Would it be valuable to have it, in your opinion?
I think the Aviation Museum in Darwin should investigate and put on some display inside there. Their museum. I was there 2 months ago and they had absolutely nothing, so I did advise them, but whether they've pursued it, I don't know.
Knowing that you were involved, where does it sit in your overall memories?
One of significant events over the years, amongst others, but yeah.
That report from Oscar Wills speaking there to Bob Nesdaloff, a retired member of the RAAF. And tomorrow we'll have more coverage on the 50th anniversary of the moon landing.
This week on Landline, farmers push to breaking point as wild deer run rampant.
It could get as bad as rabbits. Like, I've been harping on for 5 years and it's getting worse, you know.
And a hands-on training program attracting new blood to the bush.
It's not the old stale ways of doing farming. Like, there's everything's evolving and you've got to move with it.
And a baby boom, bringing new life to a small country town. That's Landline 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
You're on Australia Wide with Alex Hyman. To Tasmania now, where a farm school has used the experience of an opportunistic wedge-tailed eagle as a learning tool for its students. A wedge-tailed eagle has been swooping into the animal pen at Hagley Farm School and carrying away fully grown chickens. The school decided to turn the experience into a positive learning exercise for the students by demonstrating what farmers deal with on a regular basis. Fred Hooper visited the farm school in Hagley.
We absolutely love the wedge-tailed eagles. They're a stunning sight to see when they're in our environment. But obviously for our enterprise it was a bit of a risk losing so many girls and we wanted to protect them as much as we could.
That's the principal from Hagley Farm School in northern Tasmania, Gina Viney, and she's talking about protecting the school's chicken population from wedge-tailed eagle attacks.
I wouldn't say our students have been upset. As I said, you know, it's a learning opportunity for them. They do we love our girls and we want to protect them, but they do certainly understand that it is part of life on the farm. They don't like losing them, but they understand why that happens.
Scott Watson is a teacher at the school. Standing in the middle of the chicken paddock, Scott turns around to point to the spot where an eagle swooped in to pick up a chicken.
One of our parents was in the car park and watched an eagle come down one day and take a chicken who had wandered off. So that gave us number one alert, and from there we progressed with those ideas to the point where we are now.
The school worked with a local biologist and wildlife expert to come up with a plan to help control the eagles.
We think we've lost about 20 chickens over a few weeks, but our students have been really busy creating some scarecrows and some shade areas for the chickens to shelter in, and that seems to have worked. So we've reduced down to, I think we've only lost about one chicken in the recent week.
Hagley Farm School has about 380 students. They have shearing and dairy demonstrations, as well as quite a large egg enterprise.
We have about 300 chickens, and they luxuriate in our front paddocks of the Hagley School. Their eggs are collected daily, and we sell them around the nearby areas of Hagley, as well as into Prospect. So it's an enterprise in itself. We expect the girls to lay well for us.
The school uses the chicken enterprise as a learning tool for the students, and they have a great name for it.
So Eggheads is a lovely group. It's a rotational group amongst the school in our grade 3-4 classes, and they work with Mrs O'Connor, one of our teacher assistants, and they come out daily and they collect the eggs from our sheds and they then take them off to our egg shed where they prepare the eggs for sale, right through to the boxing and the preparation so that they're ready to go off to sale in the shops.
A couple of the students are sitting among the chickens, explaining their part in Eggheads.
It's really fun because you get to go and collect the eggs and then we get to sanitise them and package them.
While it hasn't been ideal to lose chickens to eagles, the students have been able to learn from this real-life issue that farmers face.
They've been trying to eat all the chickens that are going off by and wandering by themselves.
Because they're watching a lot and they're really intelligent.
The other day we built some scarecrows and we've been moving them around on Mondays and Fridays.
Fred Hooper there speaking with students from the Hagley Farm School in Tasmania. And finally, tonight, Midnight Oil will take to the stage to headline what's billed as the most remote music festival on the planet. Over the last 3 days, over 9,000 festival goers have called the Birdsville Big Red Bash home, right on the edge of the Simpson Desert, to see the likes of The Oils, The Living End and Casey Chambers. But there's also been the Nutbush Dance World Record attempt, the dress-up drag race to raise money for the Flying Doctors, sandboarding and more. Ollie Wycombe joined the festival fun and met a couple of punters who had travelled from the far corners of the country.
I spotted a family wandering through the Big Red Bash with surfing t-shirts on. I've got Beans here. Beans, this is such a quintessentially Australian festival. We've got the mixture of culture and all this kind of stuff. And then we've got from sandboarding to surfing. You must feel right at home.
Absolutely we do, yeah. No, it's great. All we wanted to do when we thought about coming here was show our kids out back the real Australia. And this is what we've done and we're doing it. And it's great. It's awesome.
It must be such a change to go from the green Margaret River to red Big Red.
Oh, totally, yeah. Margaret River's raining and wet and, you know, lots of trees, high trees and green, and then we get here and it's just desert and deserted and it's just, oh, the contrast's amazing. It's beautiful.
I've cornered Glenn from Victoria. He's all the way from the sunny suburbs of Melbourne. And Glenn's a bit of an expert in desert travel, aren't you, Glenn? How many times have you crossed the Simpson Desert?
Four times now, yep.
So what's the highlight when you hit the desert and you're going out, going across it? What's the thing that you kind of look out for? Why do you get drawn back to it?
The peace and quiet. I've always loved a bit of a challenge, and it's just a different world. It's so different to Victoria. It's just something about it that just keeps you coming back. Just love it.
That's Ollie Wycombe there at the Birdsville Big Red Bash, and we might check in with Ollie tomorrow if we can. That's the show for today. Thanks so much for your company. I'll be back again tomorrow. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a great evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.